Well, welcome. My name is Jarrett Cummings. I'm a policy specialist with the EDUCAUSE Washington office. I actually started with EDUCAUSE as program administrator for the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative. I ran about three or four of these annual meetings, so it's great to be on this side of the line as opposed to worrying about all of the details behind the scenes, although our current ELI staff are doing a tremendous job. So it's a pleasure for me to be a speaker in this context. Now, as part of my responsibilities with the EDUCAUSE Washington office, I follow policy issues that impact the development and delivery of e-learning. And that's become a much more interesting space over the last couple of years, and I think it's going to get much more interesting still. So in today's session, what I'd like to talk about are some of the driving factors behind the recent spate of e-learning policy and regulation that we've seen. Look at some of the key impacts of those developments, as well as some of the community responses to them, because I think there's been some significant progress made on some issues within the community, collaborating, working together. And then finally, I'd like to talk about a few issues that I think are going to impact e-learning over the next couple of years that haven't really, I think, hit the broad radar yet, but are going to. So first, I think it's important to look at the context around e-learning and really the context around higher education generally, because I think that is the locus for much of what we're seeing in the e-learning policy space. And I think much of it's been driven by the fact that e-learning has become more and more central to higher education and thus has become increasingly impacted by the policy concerns about higher education generally. So starting with the traditional, it's been long understood that within our society and economy, income is really driven by educational attainment. Many of you may have heard the statistic that someone with a bachelor's degree on average will earn $1 million more over their lifetime than someone with a high school education alone. What I don't think is commonly understood is how dated that statistic is. I remember pulling it up from a U.S. Department of Education, National Center for Education Statistics report back in the 90s. So what we see here is some more recent data analyzed by the Center for Education and the Workforce at Georgetown University, which shows that the return on investment in higher education has not just been great, but it's been accelerating over the last several years. What this shows is that someone with a bachelor's degree, on average, will earn almost double what someone with a high school degree alone would achieve over their lifetime. And someone with an associate's degree would earn $500,000 more on average over their lifetime than someone with a high school diploma alone. So in this context, what I think it really comes down to is, despite some of the more recent discussion about challenging the value of higher education to individual economic achievement, the data show that, generally speaking, the returns on investment in higher education continue to accelerate. And I think that's in part because simple employability is increasingly being driven by educational attainment. Again, what the Center for Education and the Workforce found is that within the next 5 years, over 60% of jobs will require some college education, and nearly half of all jobs will require an associate's degree or greater. So in an environment in which education determines income, we're also seeing increasingly that education determines whether you have access to the job market to begin with. And that makes the stakes for higher education much higher than they've ever been before. Thus, it's no surprise that early in the Obama administration, the president set forth a goal to restore the United States to leadership in the world in the proportion of college graduates by 2020. However, as this statement shows, that's a very broad goal to set. So the White House worked with its Council of Economic Advisors, the National Center for Higher Education Management Systems, the Delta Cost Project, and others to better define the goal into something that's not just achievable, but something we can track and develop policy to try to achieve. So they focused the goal on achieving 60% of adults aged 25 to 34 with a college degree by 2020. Now, with that more defined goal, we now have a better sense for what the challenge we face as a nation to achieve it is. What NCHIMS found is that baseline growth in college attainment would get us to 42% of 25 to 34-year-olds with a college degree by 2020. If we want to get to that 60% level, we would need an additional 8 million graduates in that cohort in order to hit 60% attainment. What that means is that from 2010 to 2020, we need to see 4% annual growth in college degree production. However, the most recent figures, those for the 2009-10 academic year, show that we grew college attainment by only 0.5% in that year. And I think it's safe to say that we've seen nothing in the higher education space to indicate that we've dramatically accelerated the degree attainment rate since then. So thus, we're now at 2013, we're that much closer to 2020, and we really don't have a sense that we're any closer to hitting that 60% goal. At the same time, college cost growth is increasingly seen as a factor that's inhibiting achievement of our college attainment objectives. What the College Board found is that roughly over the last decade, published tuition and fees at public four-year institutions grew by nearly 6% over the rate of inflation, while published tuition and fees at private four-year institutions and public two-year institutions grew at roughly 3% and 4% respectively over the rate of inflation in that time frame. Now, there's a real problem with how the public is perceiving and policymakers are perceiving this published growth in tuition and fees, because the reality is almost no student pays the published tuition and fees. It's net price that really matters. Net tuition and fees after student aid is factored in into the equation. However, we live in an environment in which family income in the United States at all levels was lower in 2010 than it was in 2000. So we have an environment in which the public and policymakers are looking at this perceived growth in tuition and fees through the lens of declining family incomes, and thus seeing this increasingly important product, for lack of a better word, a higher education, growing increasingly out of reach for the average family. This creates a very delicate policy environment, and it leads to some of the policy responses we're going to talk about shortly. However, before I get to those, I'd like to focus a little bit on the good news first, which is that for our community, e-learning is increasingly seen as part of the solution, both at the national level and at the state level. So as an example, at the national level, former Federal Communications Commission Chair Reed Hunt worked with his former Chief of Staff, Blair Levin, who also most recently oversaw the Obama administration's development of a national broadband plan for the United States. They recently published an e-book in which one of their key tenets was arguing for a significant role for e-learning in achieving the nation's economic objectives. And so they proposed a three-step model to do that, beginning with the migration of all learning content into the digital space, followed by creating more effective and broader-based assessment mechanisms, and then finally establishing a broad national framework for student data exchange to foster student education across sectors and across institutions. But the real key takeaway is that they see e-learning as central to the discussion, not just of achieving our national educational objectives, but of achieving our national economic objectives. I think that's a huge shift in the policy space around e-learning. At the same time, Governor Brown of California is probably the most recent example and the most vocal example of a state leader driving on e-learning as a way to achieve his state's educational objectives, both in terms of meeting demand as well as balancing costs. And as this quote shows, he has directly tied the concept of e-learning to more access and more cost-effective access to higher education. Now, that is fraught with some difficulties in and of itself. But in this context, we're looking at the good news first, which is you have a major state leader who's really pushing for the development of e-learning within his state public institutions, so much so that in his current budget, he has specifically allocated $37 million to that effort. Some other examples of developments that show e-learning's rise within the public discussion. You may have heard that in around mid-January, San Jose State, with the governor's support, announced a three-course pilot project with Udacity to pilot some of Udacity's MOOC mechanisms within three entry-level math courses as an effort to see if, by incorporating those mechanisms, they could deliver those entry-level courses more cost-effectively and more effectively in terms of learning outcomes. Another development in this space, the American Council on Education has now penned agreements with both Udacity and Coursera to evaluate a small number of each organization's courses to see if ACE might recommend them for transfer credit as part of ACE's transfer recommendation service. ACE also is beginning a Gates-funded grant program, or a Gates-funded program, to explore what MOOCs might mean for the higher education space generally. So that's another major development. Back to our California example, Governor Brown late last year pushed for and got a commitment to the development of free online e-textbooks for the top 50 courses across California's public institutions, where their legislation was really modeled on the Washington State Technical and Community College systems effort with the Open Course Library to establish open educational resources for the top 42 courses in that system. And then finally, we've seen a few states partner with Western Governors University to establish state-branded campuses of Western Governors University for their states, which in some cases will allow citizens to use state-based financial aid to pursue degrees online with Western Governors University. So all of these are just examples of the churn that is taking place in the policy space, or where e-learning is seen as a possible mechanism to achieve public higher education goals. Unfortunately, I think they're taking place in an environment that still has some significant inhibiting factors. One of the major ones is the degree to which policymakers are concerned about student debt in the for-profit higher education space, and the degree to which some policymakers tend to conflate all of e-learning with for-profit higher education. And we've seen this in legislation that's come out of Senator Harkin's committee, the Higher Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, as well as in some other spaces. So what this chart shows is that the proportion of students in the for-profit space borrowing to finance their education far and away exceeds that proportion in any of the traditional sectors of higher education. So much so that the roughly 11% of the post-secondary student population that is in the for-profit higher education space accounts for nearly 25% of federal student aid, some $32 billion a year. Unfortunately, they also account for nearly half of all student loan defaults, with one in five students in for-profit higher education or who have either left or graduated from for-profit higher education, defaulting on their student loans within the first 3 years of leaving their program. This has created an environment where there's intense focus on managing the for-profit higher education space, ensuring that students are getting what they're paying for in the for-profit higher education space, but it's taking place through mechanisms that have a broad impact on higher education generally, and thus impacts some developments at traditional colleges and universities in a way that might not be appropriate. Another major concern at the national level is about the extent to which states are taking seriously their oversight responsibilities for post-secondary education. California, again, provides another excellent example. before Governor Moonbeam, as he was known in his first stint as governor of California. I don't agree with that characterization, but, you know, I'm going to take a laugh line where I can get it. Before him, we had the governator. And Governor Schwarzenegger's conflicts with the California state legislature are well known and well documented. One of the outcomes that went somewhat under the radar is that in the midst of one of those legislative battles, both the governor and the legislature let the authority for the state agency that oversaw non-regionally accredited for-profit higher education in the state sunset without any plan or mechanism for fulfilling its responsibilities. Thus, over a two-year winding road, this was the best I could do to come up with a winding road. Sorry, my graphics capabilities are somewhat limited. State of California essentially got back to where they started from, sans one letter in the acronym for the state agency. But over that time period, the state's jerry-rigged approach to managing state authorization of for-profit higher education providers just confirmed for the U.S. Department of Education its long-held suspicions that states were really not fulfilling in a rigorous way their authorization responsibilities. And so any time a regulator feels that there's a problem that can be solved by regulation, they're going to regulate. And that takes us to our policy response, which in this context came in the form of program integrity regulations. If you've heard that term and weren't sure what it meant, essentially the U.S. Department of Education was talking about regulations to strengthen the integrity of federal student aid programs under the Higher Education Act. As this screenshot shows, they covered quite a bit of ground in their regulatory effort. We're only going to talk about a few of those aspects of the regulation, starting with state authorization, because I think that's the one that's probably had the broadest impact on our conversations. So initially, there wasn't much concern about the department developing new regulations on state authorization, where they were essentially trying to say, here's what form of state authorization we will accept as qualifying institutions and programs for federal student aid eligibility. There wasn't a lot of concern about that initially because the definition that they originally discussed was very consistent with the traditional understanding of state authorization, which is that it concerns the authorization of institutions physically located within a specific state. Unfortunately, when they actually developed the final regulations without much discussion, they extended the definition of state authorization to online distance education in a way that really shifted that concept completely from an institution and its programs having to be authorized by the state in which they were physically located to having to have state authorization anywhere a program was delivered, regardless of how many students they might have, the extent of the program that might be delivered online, et cetera. This created a lot of concern because, as this map from EduVentures shows, there's a wide array of state authorization requirements across the states, starting, again, I'll stay out west with California, our nice bright green, where there were no specific requirements for a considerable period of time, and perhaps not to this day, on online providers in relation to state authorization. Whereas with our red states, we have laws that specifically address the authorization requirements of online distance education programs. And this map is now even a little bit dated because the state in which I reside, Maryland, has since gone from blue to red in this context. They didn't go from blue to red in the presidential election, but in the context of state authorization, they have. Since this chart was originally developed, they have imposed specific authorization requirements for online programs operating in the state. So we have a situation in which we have to find a way to harmonize all of these requirements across the states if institutions and programs are going to operate cost effectively at a national level. The good news in this context came when a federal district court overturned the U.S. Department of Education's extension of state authorization specifically to online distance education. saying that the department essentially didn't follow the appropriate rules in making that regulation. And later, a circuit court of appeals upheld, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia upheld the federal district court's ruling, which essentially severed the requirement or severed the link between state authorization of online distance education programs and federal student aid eligibility. What it couldn't do is change the fact that many programs and institutions were operating in states in conflict with the laws of those states, largely through ignorance. They simply didn't know, and the states were becoming increasingly aware of these efforts. So that led to a new hope. Any Star Wars fans in the audience? Going once, going twice? One, we got one. So A New Hope Rises was actually the chapter name for the original Star Wars movie. Just a little bit of trivia if you find yourself playing Trivial Pursuit. But in this context, the new hope was Sarah, the concept of a state authorization reciprocity agreement. So because state authorization is by definition a state responsibility, within our federal system, the only really effective way to address it would be to get states to agree to recognize each other's authorization of post-secondary institutions. And so a number of groups started to work on developing a reciprocity model, probably the most well-known being the President's Forum Council of State Governments effort, where they were really focused on developing a model agreement which would try to capture all of the various issues across institutions and states that a reciprocity agreement might conceivably have to address. Given that they were really operating at that model level, they didn't focus too terribly much on implementation, and that's where a few months later, the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education, or WICHE, started looking at how the regional higher education compact organizations like WICHE, like the Southern Regional Education Board, the New England Board of Higher Education, could become the implementation vehicles for a reciprocity model. In translating from that model framework to something that was more focused on implementation, some key changes were discussed, and I've tried to highlight those here. First, in the model agreement, you saw a situation where you had higher education representatives working with state regulators to try to capture the various academic quality requirements. And in some states, those academic quality requirements exceed regional accreditation. So within a model agreement, they were trying to define a baseline that all states might ultimately accept. In looking at practical implementation, WICHE came back and said, look, if a state wants to have additional requirements for institutions that reside within its borders, that's definitely within its purview to do. But when we talk about reciprocity, recognizing authorization across states, we really need to focus on regional accreditation as the coin of the realm. Similarly, I mentioned that WICHE viewed the existing regional higher education organizations as the potential implementation vehicles so that we could capture those existing infrastructures and use them to support the effort, as opposed to, within the model agreement, looking at the traditional state regulation framework of an interstate commission that would govern the whole process. WICHE felt that by looking at the regional higher education compacts, you could achieve what you needed to achieve in a much more practical and cost-effective way. And then finally, within the WSARA framework, they specifically highlighted for financial viability the issue of relying on the existing federal framework for determining financial viability for institutions to participate in federal student aid as the same baseline for state authorization reciprocity. So those are the major differences as we move from a model approach to something that could actually be implemented on the ground. Well, if some new hope is good, there are people who think more new hope is better. And what I mean by that is that as these other efforts were converging, the State Higher Education Executive Officers and the Association for Public and Land-Grant Universities established a commission for education regulation in higher education, with the idea being that any reciprocity model that's ultimately adopted needed to reflect the concerns and interests of institutions and to maintain a balance between state oversight concerns and institutional concerns. The good news is the commission has been working with WICHE and the regional higher education compacts on this issue. There will not be multiple STERAs at the end of the day. They're moving towards trying to have an integrated framework, but the commission's still trying to work through some key issues around how national governance would work, for example, or what the fee structure institutions would face to help finance the reciprocity process. In terms of where STERA is going from here, all of the regional higher education compact organizations have started to look at how they would approach reciprocity within their regions, and they're also talking about how they would develop a national coordinating board to harmonize those regional approaches into a national framework. As I said, they are working with the APLU-SHIO Commission as well to make sure that institutional interests are appropriately reflected. And all of this is steering towards an implementation symposium that the Lumina Foundation has funded, which will take place in mid-April in Indianapolis. So hopefully that will be kind of the constitutional convention among the various parties to really kick off implementation of a reciprocity agreement. So with that, again, going back to some good news, reciprocity is coming to a location near you. It's just not likely to come before 2014. There are just too many moving parts here that have to be brought together. And in some cases, even though you have states who participate actively in these regional higher education compacts, specific state laws are going to have to be changed to allow them to participate in a reciprocity agreement within those regional compacts. So when in 2014 this might happen is an open question, but I think at least we have a time frame that's on the horizon in which it might take place. So as you await that august development, it pays to keep an eye on SHIO's state authorization resources site. They maintain an annual survey of the different states' authorization requirements as well as the key contacts for those authorization processes. So if you're operating an e-learning program outside your state of any significance, this is probably the best place to find out what authorization requirements you currently face are if you don't already know them. Likewise, I highly recommend keeping an eye on the WCET Frontiers blog. That's the WICHE Cooperative for Educational Technology. Some of you might recognize the handsome gentleman there in the middle. That's Russ Poulin, who's the WCET Deputy Director for Research and Analysis. I think I got his title right. If I didn't, Russ, if you're listening, please correct me. But Russ is probably the one person who's most tied into the reciprocity agreement process. So when he talks about it, I listen and I highly urge you to as well. Some other aspects of program integrity that we're dealing with. One of the regulations that was not overturned was a requirement that institutions provide for all their students, not just their e-learning students, information about where a student can go to file a complaint against the institution, both with their state as well as with the institution's accrediting body. Early on, this was a big concern because the department said not only did institutions need to do that, but each institution had to do it itself. It could not link to a third-party provider of that information to meet that requirement. However, last summer, I think largely based upon SHIO's work, because among those state authorization resources, as I said, SHIO also maintains a directory of what the state complaint processes are and where you go to get that information. I think largely because that comprehensive resource has been developed, the department relented and said, okay, you can, as an institution, you can meet our regulatory requirement by just linking to that as long as you understand that you individually are responsible for the currency of that information. Similarly, another issue that gained a lot of notoriety was the development of a federal definition of the credit hour. I've tried to break that down into key components here, but it really, I think, as an issue came down to what the U.S. Department of Education thought it was achieving versus what the higher education community thinks it did. So by breaking down the definition here, what I've tried to show is that I believe the department thought that it was providing institutions with greater flexibility to meet federal student aid requirements using a competency-based assessment model instead of just a credit hour model. They were basically, I believe, trying to say, look, as long as you can show the crosswalk between the two, you can rely on competency-based assessment. However, the higher education community generally reacted with the view that this was significant federal overreach into the academic affairs of the institution, and in fact created a difficult situation in which you would now have the credit hour determined by federal regulation and therefore not as flexible when flexibility could be preserved by accreditation continuing to address the issue as it always had. For e-learning specifically, I think the value of this debate is that it has spotlighted interest in competency-based assessment and brought to light the need to address key issues around it. On the downside, this regulation was not overturned. We live in a world where the credit hour is now defined in federal regulation, and what that means for institutions generally, not just their e-learning programs, remains something that we're simply going to learn over time as we discover how the department is or isn't going to implement this regulation. Another issue, I think, of significant interest was the department's push into gainful employment reporting. The Higher Education Act contains specific provisions regarding programs that lead to careers specifically or gainful employment, but it had not previously propagated specific regulations under that space. Well, with the concerns about for-profit higher education, the department took the opportunity to exercise its regulatory authority to start establishing some measures by which those programs and institutions could be held accountable for actually helping students achieve gainful employment. Now, this regulation impacted over 80% of higher education institutions. However, it was predominantly an issue for for-profit institutions and non-degree programs within traditional colleges and universities. So while its impacts from an institutional standpoint are broad, within institutions, you're generally at least within traditional institutions, you're talking about a relatively narrow swath of programs that might have had to meet these reporting requirements. However, this was another situation in which a court case was filed in this by the Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities against the department to overturn these regulations, where the then in effect regulations were overturned, but not the department's authority to make regulations in that space. Essentially, what the court found is that the department was well within its authority to develop gainful employment measures for federal student aid eligibility for such programs. However, the metrics that they put forward were not adequately justified. They simply had not provided sufficient basis to say these are the requirements to which institutions should be held. So with that, it's likely that the department will revisit this issue. How it will impact higher education generally, I think, is largely in setting forth concepts and possible frameworks for extending gainful employment concepts to non-gainful employment programs, or what we call traditional higher education. And that's something I'll talk about a bit more in a moment. So, in looking ahead to issues that are emerging on the horizon, I think one that is likely to catch our attention very, very soon, in many cases it already has, but I think that awareness is going to grow, is the issue of IT accessibility. What I've highlighted here is a video developed by the University of Washington with support from the National Science Foundation, which really tried to show higher education leaders in their own words talking about the importance of IT accessibility to their institutions and to the mission of higher education generally. So I recommend it to you as a way of kind of starting to get exposure to thinking about this space. From a regulatory standpoint, the areas of concern begin with the U.S. Department of Justice already being on record saying that once the U.S. Access Board, that's the body that develops accessibility guidelines for the federal government, once it develops its web accessibility guidelines, DOJ is going to take those and incorporate them into its regulations under the Americans with Disabilities Act, thus giving them the force of law. For institutions, that's going to have significant impacts on our web presences generally. Obviously, for learning that's delivered online, the degree to which you are or are not compliant with web accessibility guidelines could become a significant issue. Meanwhile, the National Federation of the Blind is also urging Congress to take up a key recommendation from a federally chartered commission on instructional materials, accessible instructional materials in post-secondary education. And one of the key recommendations of that commission was that the Congress direct the Access Board to develop guidelines, accessibility guidelines for accessible, develop guidelines for instructional materials accessibility in post-secondary education. And they are also very much interested in seeing the Department of Justice follow that same path. Once such guidelines are developed, they would very much like to see the Department of Justice incorporate those into regulations under the Americans with Disabilities Act. That has significant implications for our existing courses, for our future courses, for how those courses are delivered online and what technologies are used to deliver them. So this is a space that, I urge you to keep an eye on. Similarly, some of you may have heard about the financial aid fraud rings that impacted online programs at low-cost open enrollment providers, such as some community colleges and for-profit institutions. Basically, what was happening was that fraud ring leaders were getting people to conspire with them by sharing their sharing their personal identities, such that the fraud ring leader could then take those identities and enroll a fake student into the program and also apply for financial aid on that basis, stay in just long enough to get the financial aid award, and then disappear. This has brought a very heightened level of interest to the issue of student identity verification, how institutions can know that the person who applies for entrance into a course and applies for financial aid is the person who's actually taking the course and receiving the financial aid. The U.S. Department of Education initially said they were going to try to develop regulations in this space before the election. The election got in the way, so that was postponed. When they plan to take that issue up is not yet known. But, of course, a major concern is going to be how we can implement any sort of verification approach in a cost-effective and operationally effective manner within our programs. Because the initial state authorization regulation was on online distance education was overturned on a technicality, there's every possibility that the department might choose to revisit that issue with new regulations. Essentially, all they have to do is restart the regulatory process and follow the rules this time. In this context, though, with the development of the SARA models, this may, if the department revisits this issue, it may actually become a positive thing as opposed to the negative it initially was, because it may provide institutions and the regional higher education compacts with leverage vis-a-vis their states to say, you really need to get on board with this reciprocity model, or our programs, our online programs, are going to lose federal student aid eligibility. So, in this context, if the department does choose to revisit state authorization of online distance education, it could be a positive next time. And then finally, I mentioned the gainful employment issue. This quote from U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan shows the extent to which at the federal level there's increased interest in performance-based and outcomes-based models for holding higher education institutions accountable. And what we're seeing at the state level is that when we talk about performance-based or outcomes-based accountability, it's usually linked to workforce outcomes of graduates. So what the National Conference of State Legislatures is providing is a map that's tracking the development of performance-based budgeting across the states, where in many cases the performance institutions within those states are being held to relates to how their graduates are doing in the workforce. This takes the whole impetus behind the gainful employment regulations and extends it to higher education funding generally. And I think there are significant questions about the extent to which those mechanisms apply when you move from programs that are specifically intended to take a student into a specific career versus in my case, a philosophy major, where you could not have predicted that I would have had a career after graduation, much less the career that I currently have. So this is going to be a significant issue moving forward, what outcomes-based accountability for higher education means and the extent to which we can educate policymakers about the separation, or perhaps a better way of putting it is the more appropriate way to assess workforce outcomes in the context of higher education accountability generally. And thus, I think competency-based assessment becomes a very important issue. These are examples of some institutions that incorporate in whole or in part competency-based assessment into their programs. In Western Governor's case, they have been doing that crosswalk that we talked about earlier between their competency-based assessment approach and the credit hour for quite some time, whereas Southern New Hampshire University is the first institution to apply for federal student aid recognition of a couple of its programs specifically under competency-based assessment authority. So it's going to be very interesting to see how Southern New Hampshire's programs are dealt with by the department. It's very interesting that they were able to get that past their accreditor in the first place, so it may signal a new openness to this space. But as we think about the potential for workforce outcomes as accountability measures for higher education, the extent to which competency-based assessment is going to become more and more central to those discussions, I think is something that we're going to have to pay attention to. So with that, I think I left just a few minutes for questions and answers. So I'm going to go ahead and provide my contact information. If you have questions that we can't address in this time frame, please contact me. I'd be happy to address them with you. If you have a question, please go to the microphone in the back so that the people online – oh, actually, we have somebody who's walking the mic for us. So thank you.
Hi. You may have covered this and I missed it, but do you is there a differentiation between online programs that provide credit and those that do not provide credit for the identity verification?
I have not yet seen that discussion, although most of the – there are two parts to it. When it comes to the fraud issue, since non-degree programs – if we're talking about MOOCs specifically, since they are generally free, there wouldn't be an issue in relation to federal student aid. If you have non-degree and I think federal student aid really only applies to for-credit courses and programs generally, although I could be wrong about that. I'd have to talk to some people who know a little bit more about federal student aid to be sure. But in the 2008 reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, that issue of identity verification originally arose in the context of academic integrity, where the department was concerned that institutions didn't have a good enough handle on whether the student who enrolled in a course was actually the student who completed the coursework and received the credit. And so as part of that discussion, accrediting agencies were required, as part of the accreditation process, to verify that institutions had a legitimate process for authenticating student identity in relation to the courses and programs they were taking. That really boiled down to a requirement that each student have their own login for relevant learning management systems and course materials and so forth. So that's a very minimal level of authentication. Whether that will hold up as we move into this new regulatory space, whether more requirements will be layered on top of that, I think is an open question.
So you were talking about it previously more and tied to student aid. Mm-hmm. You've also seen it addressed in this accreditation conversation, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's already part of federal regulations related to higher education accreditation, but there it's largely focused on course and program access to learning materials, and proof that the person who accessed the course is the person doing the coursework, taking the test, and so forth. So that discussion has largely generated a lot of momentum around remote proctoring or requiring students to go to testing centers, things of that nature. When it comes to the federal student aid issue, it shifts because now you're talking about application for admissions to the institution and federal student aid applications.
Okay.
Is that, did I muddy the water or make it clear?
No, you, it's helpful. I mean, obviously we're, I'm from the IT organization at Brown University, and MOOCs have pushed this issue, but even as our programs become more open and we're looking at more diverse populations, we may or may not have the ability to have them confirm their identity on our campuses. They may never be on our campuses, and we may not care if the course or the program is not degree granting. We may trust them to say that they are who they say they are, and use social identity, you know, use confirm identity through other types of authentication, like their Facebook account or their Gmail account. But that's, I'm just wondering kind of what the thinking is.
Yeah, I would say generally you're probably right that if it's not credit granting, it's probably not going to be an issue. From a technical standpoint, it may be simply a matter of how many different authentication mechanisms you want to implement.
Right. I mean, that's kind of where we are. So we've been taking that framework. We look at it differently if there's no credits being applied, but I do wonder how long that will be okay.
Well, and you know, taking a slightly different tack, you know, the back on state authorization and the Minnesota example, where that was a space in which post-secondary education regulatory or legal requirements did apply, even though it was free online higher education, because the state law doesn't make a differentiation on that issue. Under the state law, if you are a post-secondary education provider operating in the state, you have to have state authorization, whether you're granting credit or not, whether you're making money or not. Now, fortunately, the state of Minnesota decided not to, after initially pushing that issue, decided not to pursue it, basically recognizing that cutting off their citizens from free online higher education because of regulatory requirements might create some political problems.
Regarding the national reciprocity agreements, everything seems to be focused on distance learning. And I know at our institution we have even gotten to the point where we've limited access to students from certain states because it's just not worth it to us to be compliant in those states. We just don't have enough students. But what it's also done is shine a light on all of these other activities that we have going on, like internships, co-ops, and people who are ABD who get hired at a state in another state and have to finish their coursework or dissertation hours or something, and that's now technically delivering instruction while they're resident of another state. And it's the number of states where that's become an issue is about triple the ones that are just solely online. Will these reciprocity agreements address some of these other issues? And this is what stirred most people up on my campus, even more than online learning.
Absolutely. That's been a big focus of the discussion, is what are the existing physical presence triggers that require an institution or program to get state authorization, and what should those triggers be if there's a reciprocity model in place. And so there's specific aspects, both of the original model agreement, the Presidents Forum Council of State Governments model, which really delves into those in much greater detail, and the WSERA implementation framework to essentially say, here's what physical presence means under reciprocity. It's actually having an administrative or academic facility in the state, or actually having classes meeting at a specific location for a specific time over the context of the course. If you don't, you know, if you don't fall within one of those areas, then you don't trigger state authorization requirements. And part of what the Commission on Distance Education Regulation is still grappling with is that kind of latter point about, you know, separate and apart from whether you have an academic or administrative facility in a state, if you do have an online course that's really more of a hybrid course where you're having students in the state get together for a couple of course sections or a certain percentage of the course, is that something that has to be defined within those physical presence triggers to make sure that states don't interpret them in a way that they weren't intended? So I think that's still part of the discussion, but there's really a significant effort to narrow down what the physical presence requirements should be for the delivery of education across state borders. More.
Thanks, Jared, for your very comprehensive analysis of what's going on. This is a tough discussion, and we're all, I think, very interested in its outcome. When it comes back to the SARA discussion, one of the things that I've noticed, and you mentioned it also, that this is going to take a while before it actually comes to fruition. And my concern is, or my question, I guess, is I'm seeing some discussion, and obviously the regional discussions, where the regional compacts like SREB and WICHE and the MHEC areas will actually have, you know, the responsibility of reciprocal agreements within their areas. But those are starting to break down in some cases, because I just finished the application for your home state of Maryland, and it's 5 inches thick. And Maryland just stepped away from SREB. And so what I'm looking for, hoping to see also, is a parallel track that says, here is the reciprocal language you can take to your state legislator and see if you can't pass that there also. Are you seeing anything about that? Because I think this is going to take both pathways at least, based on the amount of time it's taking just to get to where we are now.
Yes, I think that you know, within these, with, especially as we move more into the implementation discussion, you're going to see more and more focus on what implementing legislation would need to look like. You know, there's a limit on that because, again, in different states, there are different barriers. And so in some cases, it's going to have to be the institutions within those states, perhaps working with the regional compact organization to identify, you know, how that state might need to adjust what it's doing to allow for reciprocity. The flip side of this is, you know, reciprocity is going to have its limits. There's no guarantee that all states are going to participate, especially up front. I think the view is that there will be probably a significant number of states and institutions that participate up front, and that you will see more states participate over time as they realize the barriers that their institutions face in delivering e-learning outside of their borders because they're not part of a reciprocity framework. So with that, I believe I've gotten the high sign. Thank you very much.